weather is back. This is Red Hot Weather Talk. JD Bunkus, Ben Ennis is here. It's good hour. Good morning, man. Nice hair.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, feeling good. Yeah, I have my children downstairs in the kitchen screaming. Yeah, it's nice. It's a Thursday. We're almost in March. Got no rink. Got lots of snow. I mean, a decent amount of snow. I shouldn't say lots of snow. It's a snow day, so I guess you could qualify it as lots of snow. Not lots of snow in my book, though.
I need you to hear. Did you hear this as I was clipping it before the show? Did it play down your feed?
Yeah.
Ah, damn. I was hoping that you were going to hear it for the first time. Okay, for the audience, this is at a basketball game in I don't know Waresville. They say Hamilton, but it's not Ontario, I don't think. It's in Michigan. Yeah, exactly. I felt dumb, Austin, saying it right there. Thank you for telling me Michigan, because there is a snow day here. So this combining, I went, maybe it is. But no, it didn't feel very Canadian. And also, as someone who played basketball in Canada and in Ontario, the crowd and the announcer was a pretty strong giveaway that it wasn't here. You were lucky to get like 30 people at your basketball game sometimes in Canada. And I'm not talking about the Yukon. I'm talking about here in Ontario. Okay, so here's this audio of a school hitting a buzzer beater and the superintendent immediately giving the kids a snow day yesterday in Michigan. Here it is.
And Lusk calls the snow day. Breaking news. Lusk just called a snow day right here at the student section. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I've never seen that before. Breaking news. Lusk called the snow day at Hamilton. Woo! No school for me tomorrow.
I love the end of that call. I love the end of that call. What?
Yeah, I was going to say this plays absolutely into my conspiracy theory that there is like a bank number of snow days that the school board has like scheduled or like figured out, like, is it part of the budget before a flake of snow ever hits planet Earth, the beginning of winter, and we're almost in March and they got a bunch of those bad boys that they got to use. And yeah, it snowed moderately last night. They are absolutely just trigger happy to pull the trigger on the snow day.
So I never got to experience a snow day growing up. I think maybe I would have got one when I was living in Ontario in high school because of freezing rain. But again, the town I was living in was relatively small, and I have a hard time remembering any time where they actually called it off. In the Yukon, though, it's very clear that there is no such thing. There is no weather has shut down the school because you're in the Arctic.
No school.
Well, there's also actually not a lot of snow, which is a bit of a misnomer for the Yukon. It's a semi-arid climate. So, yeah, it's not as though you get crazy snowfalls. You don't get freezing rain. There's nothing that really prevents you. It's just bitter cold, right? And you can dress for that. You can account for that. I never got a snow day, but I obviously faked sick multiple times.
Yeah,
this is where I feel envious, so envious of the new generation of kids where they have video games and they can hammer them when their parents are gone. Because I was thinking about this clip and how happy I was when I would put one over my parents and fake sick, right? Like, there's no more exhilarating feeling than when you got away with it. Because, and my parents were like, very much not the type. They were both teachers, so it wasn't exactly and they went, oh, sweet precious, stay in bed, right? It was I had to pass a test. I had to really go all out and fake it. I remember once I don't know if this even worked, but I poured like some kind of canned food into the toilet and tried to pass it off as puke. Yeah, I went that far.
And then what? You're like, hey, come look at this?
Yeah.
Like, hey, Giannis, why didn't you just flush the toilet? Like, no, come look before I flush.
Yeah, exactly. No, it seemed like a good idea at the time. I don't think that they were fooled when they saw, like, Alpha Getty rolling, like, the letters of the alphabet rolling
around.
You should
chew your Alpha Getty next time.
Yeah, I know.
It's weird that it came out fully formed.
Yeah. It spells faker in the bowl. The perfect. But I wasn't a video game kid. I never had a console until my brother got an N64, and that was years after 64 came out. Like, we'd already moved on. But I'm so envious of them because I was thinking about things I looked forward to on those fake sick days, and it was straight up watching Price is Right and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Man. Those were the things that I'd be waiting for throughout the day. That was it. I don't remember any other sweet activity from those days other than just like roaming around the house and being by yourself.
No, my 7 and 4 year old are literally, they're going to go on a 10 hour Super Smash Bros. Binge.
Oh,
like,
God.
Because I downloaded it for them on the weekend and they can't tear themselves away. Yeah, they'd be fine never leaving the house again, and just their whole lives are in front of the Nintendo Switch playing Super Smash Bros. And yeah, throwing each other off of the map on Super Smash Bros. No, it's that's all they want to do. It's all I'd want to do, truly as well. Because I was kind of like you. I was behind the times when it came to consoles. I didn't have the updated whatever was the new hotness. I guess where it goes into another realm is like when you start meeting up with your friends online. And my kids are too young for that. But yeah, like when you start having like social groups on video gaming landscapes.
Just the advantages they have, though, of being able to text your friends during a snow day like this, jumping online, playing video games, just all of the different things at their disposal. I just didn't have that. And you couldn't call your friends. There was no texting when I was in high school. It was still, pagers. And it was only drug dealers
pagers.
That had them.
Yeah. You had pagers? You had friends with pagers? I never had a friend with a pager. Friends. I mean, I was aware of some drug dealers with some pagers, but I didn't have any friends that had pagers.
No, that's how it used to be. Now you can go to a store in the nicest parts of town and be greeted by someone with an iPad who will give you like a variety, like just the deepest of menus for any kind of pot you want, versus you would get a phone call from a high school kid in a payphone telling you to meet you by the bowling alley. That was how it used to be. Anyway, your kids are off, and I am kind of curious about how you're going to keep them occupied, because we were on the phone the other day and I can't remember how this came up, but you talked about getting parental advice from me and how you don't respect it. And I stopped the conversation because I wanted to have it a little bit more here on air. I don't know why you wouldn't want parental advice from me. I understand how the parents out there, they don't want you telling them like how to discipline a kid some ways, right? Like there's certain areas where you can't judge. It's whose joke is it? There was a stand-up that had, I think it might have been Louis C.K., who had the joke about how before he was a parent, he'd see a kid crying in a grocery store and he'd go, "That poor kid," and then he'd see the parent and he'd say that, after he had kids, he'd see the parent and say, "That poor mother, that awful, awful child," putting him through hell. I get there are things where I can't go into that world and I just don't know what it's like. But I would view it as fresh set of eyes, like a person on the outside. You're too close to it. I'm on the outside. I'm like the analytics department looking at this. Like, I didn't play the game, but I've got the math here, you know? And so I don't, like, what do you think?
It's not even you. And like, those are all good points. Here's the problem, though, is like, there's very few things in my life, like work included, like sports, golf. Like, there's nothing in my life that I'm more confident in than my parenting and the decisions I make while parenting. That's the thing. When you're at the apex like I am, everybody else stinks. So like you may have some good ideas. There's lots of people that would probably benefit from your advice from the outside looking in, but not me, because I'm the best. Yeah. I'm the tippy top, and people should study me, and the world would be a better place if everybody had me as a parent.
I like how you say this as you've got headphones pulled back over your hair. You look like CC Pass with your hair pulled back in front of a bunch of bobbleheads in a room, and you're like, "I'm the best parent." It's like you.
Yeah,
look
well,
like
my
a child.
Children destroy the house like unsupervised.
Yeah, I know. Well, exactly. No, downstairs, unsupervised, probably fighting each other, biting each other. Like, who knows what they're up to? Okay, so yeah, I think I still have good parental advice for you. I think that every once in a while I drop a kernel in there and you ignore it. That you dismiss it and that you're defensive about it, and that's a classic move.
It's also
parents.
So easy
you guys
for
think
you.
You get to be on the mountain. You think you get to be on the mountain.
You there's no risk for you, right? You're like, try this extreme parenting tip, and if it doesn't work for you, that sucks. Like there's no negative side effects for me. Yeah, it must be super easy to give parenting advice from where you are. Whereas, yeah. you know, I do one little thing could be creating the next Jeffrey Dahmer, you know?
No. No, yeah, don't get them into taxidermy. That's the only thing that we learned from that show is no taxidermy ever for your kid. That's the only one. Okay, so Blue Jays, we're in spring. I gotta tell you, it's been pretty muted for me. I know you guys have been doing a lot more Jays on your show. Maybe I should be ramping it up and doing more. I'm reading a ton just about every single day, but still, I just feel so dominated by the Leafs right now. They made the Ryan O'Reilly trade, and it's all about what they're going to be ending up doing at the deadline. I'm trying to figure out who's going to go where, who could be fits on the blue line. But the one thing that has been really sitting with me, well, there's actually been two things. But one thing from the roster standpoint and one thing from the ideology standpoint. Which one do you want to start with first?
We can do the ideology thing because okay. I think it's a short one.
Okay. So I keep seeing this message from camp.
Yeah.
The Blue Jays brand message last year, it was kind of built by Vladdy. It was last year was the trailer, this year's the movie. They asked him to do that again, and he went, no. I think he regretted it. This year, it's about, quote, the next step, end quote. What does that mean to you?
No, it's that. It's maturity. It's honestly, like, I know it goes beyond this, and especially with Lourdes Gurriel Jr., it's about bringing in a guy who does help you in multiple ways in Dalton Varsho and something that they had to do. But it was honestly, it has to be, a big part of it has to be getting rid of Teoscar Hernandez and, to a lesser extent, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. And I mean, the thing that stands out in everybody's mind is like the John Schneider berating of Vlad Jr. after his sloppiness on the base pass last year, which is part of it. But also, like, if you listen to what Vlad has said this spring training about how he can get back to his 2021 offensive self, about taking pitches, about not being so aggressive, like, that's a maturity thing too. I don't know if it's directly related to having his best buddies yucking it up on the bench, but clearly there is a belief in this front office that was part of what went wrong for this team a season ago. And yes, part of it is just another year of Major League Baseball under their belts and, like, you know, getting a couple playoff games and feeling that disappointment again, and maybe that fueling their desire to win an American League East in 2023. But you saw it as part of the managerial change. One of the big reasons for dumping Charlie Montoyo and bringing in John Schneider, a guy with no experience but plenty of respect within the organization, was getting more serious. That's it. Like the last, like, almost calendar year has been about getting more serious, first with the managerial change, then with some of the trades, and now you're hearing it echoed again in spring training.
It's so weird because one of my biggest complaints lately across the board for sports is that I actually feel like, well, I shouldn't say sports, but for hockey, has been, it feels like guys don't have enough fun. And I like, this is sort of a take I've been workshopping lately, but to me, a big reason for that in hockey is that kids now, in order to make the NHL, and this is now we're seeing that generation get in there, is hockey's been professionalized, right? If you're going to put your kid through hockey now, it's so expensive, but you have to be able to pay to play, essentially, to move up the higher ranks, to play the better competition, to get more ice time, to get more skating coaches, to have better equipment. It starts to really, really stack up. And so what ends up happening is it's a lot of parents that are really pushing their kids and kind of demanding their kids to do this. And so it doesn't feel to me, again, this is why I started with parental advice, as somebody from the outside who doesn't have kids, it doesn't look super fun for a lot of them. Like, it doesn't seem as though, you know, you want to go outside and play ball hockey as much, or that the kids are driving a lot of this, that there are probably a lot of guys and girls who are being pushed by their parents to play hockey. That's your opinion as a parent. I agree.
Yeah, I think it's gross.
But you acknowledge that it exists, right? Like, as soon as for a lot of families, they go, hey, your kid's not interested in playing hockey once they're like 12, 13, and you've exposed them, and they go, yeah, that's fine, because it's super expensive. So you're out.
Yeah.
For some of the other ones, they push them, and that becomes work for the kid. And I think what we're seeing a little bit is the first generation of players really be pervasive throughout the league, where it's been a lot of kids who have had hockey as basically a job from like young age and up. And one of the things that I really love about sports right now when I see it is joy, right? And it's the reason why I loved that Blue Jays team the year that they missed the playoffs, actually, when they missed it by a game, 2021. Yeah. One of my favorite Blue Jays teams. And I guess I don't worry because we want to see that professionalism from this group, but there is a weirdness for me where I keep going, what does the maturity element actually mean for this Blue Jays team? Because I don't think it's a good thing to be watching Vladimir Guerrero Jr. play without joy, or this Blue Jays team put too much pressure on themselves. And I do think, as much as I hate the excuse of, hey, these guys are young in a profession where everybody's young, Vladdy's 23 and Bobichette's 24. And the idea that they have to be like these mature baseball players today, even though Bo, I think, very much is, it just feels a little strange to me. I don't know where I'm caught in it.
Yeah, I don't think Vlad is going to, like, he's not going to be Bobichette, who is like Mr. No. Dour, right? Like, Bo is, you never see that guy smile. That's why it was so weird to see him in his first media availability after signing a 3-year deal where he gets multiple millions of dollars probably playing into it, but having a smile on his face. So, no, you're not going to lose that from Vlad. But, you know, my favorite Blue Jays team of recent vintage was, of course, the second half 2015 Blue Jays team, which was super serious, right? Like, and too serious. And those guys, like Josh Donaldson, Troy Tulowitzki, those guys grade on their teammates when you're not winning, when they are super serious, when they are so engaged in the game and there's no fun to be had with them, around them, and you're with them in a clubhouse every day for 6 months. When you're not winning, when you're winning, it's awesome, right? And that's what we saw in the second half of 2015. So, yeah, I think you're still going to see Vlad have fun, quote unquote. I think this team needs to and does to an extent, but obviously part of what they've done outside of the additions is the subtractions of a couple of guys that they thought were not culture fits or chemistry fits. Because go back to 2015 again, right? The trade for Josh Donaldson, that was a huge add to that Blue Jays team, a guy that eventually won American League MVP, but it was also a subtraction of a couple of guys. And no offense to Adam Lind and Brett Laurie, and Brett Laurie had to be included because he was he had a lot of value on the way out to Oakland. But those were a couple of guys that I talked to Alex Anthopoulos. I mean, he understood that creating a winning baseball team was not just about looking at the baseball reference page. It was about how the personalities gel together, and felt that those guys were better on their way out than in the clubhouse for 162 games. And the Marco Estrada for Adam Lind deal looked good, like, in hindsight. But at the time, you're like, who? Like a sixth starter, like long man out of the bullpen for a guy that used to be a silver slugger who hits from the left side? I think you're going to see some of that this season play out with the substitutions of Lourdes Gurriel Jr. and Teoscar Hernandez for Kevin Kiermaier and Dalton Varsho.
Okay, the thing is, though, is that 2015 team, I can't compare them to anything because that was a group of veterans. Mm-hmm. That clubhouse was completely different.
They brought in Brandon Belt. There's like a number of veterans on this team, too. Like, and guys that are fighting for next contracts.
There are veterans on this team, Benny, but this group, this Blue Jays team, they're built around young talent. Mm-hmm. Their best players are in their early 20s. Vlad Jr., Alek Manoah, Bo Bichette. Again, I'm probably overanalyzing this to a certain degree. I'm sure that they're going to have more fun than I'm realizing it. I just wonder how much front offices do try to balance this equation of, okay, you've got a clubhouse. You've got guys who are traveling together every single day for a long period of time. It's 162 games. And the idea of like the next step and the pressure ramping up for a group that is still young, that does have expectations, and trying to find that right line of, hey, we still want you to enjoy what you do. We still want you to go to the ballpark and not feel like there's an abundance of pressure, that there's too much pressure on you. Like, look at the Leafs right now. They're in that spot where there actually is urgency. And what's the thing people fear is that they're going to choke, that they're going to get to that big moment and it's going to overwhelm them. And I don't think the Jays are going to choke all of a sudden because of this. I do just wonder.
That.
Yeah, but it does feel like a pretty... Like, the closer I get to this thing, it does feel like just a more severe personality and cultural shift.
Yeah, it is. I like I said, like, those guys were huge components of this team. And like, no closer friends on this team, again, from an outsider perspective and talking to people who are around the team all the time. Vlad, I mean, in every broadcast, you pan to the dugout, and it's Vlad with Teo and Lourdes. And now those guys aren't there. And I get like it sounds like I'm disparaging those guys, which I kind of am, right? Like, but they're great players, and Teoscar Hernandez is a silver slugger and a great offensive player. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. to a lesser extent, and certainly like health, this team yeah. emphasized defense in the offseason. Ultimately, like, this sport is so weird, though, that, I mean, you can talk about chemistry. It's not like hockey, right? You don't have yeah. to pass anyone the puck, and yeah, you do have to spend more physical time next to these people than you do in any other sport because you are playing every day, and that's a component to it. But, like, yeah, during the course of a game, I don't know if chemistry matters as much. Maybe it's like preparation. And again, I'm not talking about guys not working chemistry, hard enough.
Chemistry clearly doesn't matter. To me, so much of this is about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Like, it's impossible not to relate it back to him. My only thing is, it's this year for him when they go, what's maturity with this group, what's taking the next step with this group? I just wonder how much of this is just purely targeted at Vladdy for them saying, we want you to unlock that MVP level player because the guy you were last year we're not good enough to win with, and we feel like you can win. We can win if you're just the better guy.
They were good enough to win 92 games and, yeah, get to the playoffs. And then at that point, it's kind of a coin flip. And they had a big lead in a playoff game against
Everything's
Seattle
a coin
Mariners.
Flip. That's, but no. But I love that about sports now. Is like every time we get to play Leafs, it was just a coin flip with with Tampa. Hey,
well, I mean, they did go to overtime in a game six.
Yeah,
a one-goal game in game seven. I mean,
It's all coin flips.
I will admit that there was an element of luck to, you know, getting some ill-timed interference calls in the postseason.
But the biggest thing, the bigger part of this is that it really does come down to finite margins, right? It's going to come down to small little details and trying to get that one little percentage point of something. And so clearly they feel like, hey, this is the thing that's going to get us that one percentage point higher.
Yep.
I do wonder how much of it is when we spend all this time going, hey, defense and how much of this is going to be like more left-handed. That makes way more sense. But the chemistry element being just simply you need your best player to take that step into whatever the maturity situation is. That this isn't so much about the group, because I look around and I see now that they do have this team full of just hardcore baseball. You can
who's
say
the guy
fun.
That you would like maybe count on to have fun? It's like one guy. It's Vlad Jr.
Yeah.
Because they got rid of all his buddies. Yeah, the rest of this team doesn't feel carefree. Like, and Alec Manoah is young, but he's super serious too. Bo Bichette, we just mentioned how serious he is.
They brought in Chris Bassett. They brought in Brandon Belt. Like, Varsho is a hardo. Like, they went for that type of personality trait across the board.
Yep. But you're right to focus on Vlad, because obviously, like, his performance is the biggest X factor in the performance of this team. It always is, right? Like, that's the conversation we had last year. Could he replicate what he did in 2021 being the best offensive player in the American League? And he couldn't. He was good, right? Like, you have to say that in every Vlad conversation, you have to say, like, oh, the 830 OPS was good, and lots of people would fall over backwards to do what he did in winning a Gold Glove. Yeah, this is a guy that has MVP ceiling, and this team is a 100-win team if he can go back to his 2021 self, which I think he rightly identified as play discipline. Like, yeah, you can look at the launch angle stuff, which it was cut in half last season, but it's all because he's swinging at pitches that he can make contact on because he's such an incredible hitter. But what did we talk about when he was just killing everything in the minor leagues about, you know, how his transition to the major leagues would look like? We thought this was going to be a guy that took a bunch of walks, a guy that had, like, just an institutional knowledge of the strike zone. And really, from the word go, we've seen it rarely. That 2021 season, we did see it because everyone was terrified he was going to hit it to Mars if they threw it over the middle of the plate. He needs to get back to that. And it's just getting into hitters' counts or being more selective in the zone. And I call it maturity, call it whatever. Maybe Teoscar Hernandez was telling him to be more aggressive. I don't know what it is, but it all hinges the success of the 2023 Blue Jays and the idea that they can go from 92 wins, or what FanGraphs predicts them at, 88 to like 95. Is Vlad Jr. have an OPS of like 950 or 1,000?
FanGraphs projects them at 88, eh?
Yeah.
Huh. I hope that's wrong. I hope that's really wrong. 88 would kind of suck. There's two things with it, and this is kind of where it's leading for me, is Two things. One, as a fan, I think that, and maybe this has just been the Leafs thing, when you're so hyper-focused on the destination, I feel like it really does sap a lot of the joy from the journey. And like some of this Leafs year has been fun watching these guys, but it always feels worse when they lose because people go, well, this is why they're not going to win. And I get that's what regular seasons are about and whatever. But I do feel like it's not as enjoyable of experience because of where they're at right now as a franchise. And this happened with the Raptors where they were extremely fun. And then they reached that point where you go, hey, you guys got to win now. You got to win now. You got to beat LeBron. Otherwise, it's not fun. And so all of this regular season kind of feels meaningless and pointless. And I'm worried about that coming a little too soon for the Blue Jays. Like I am. I don't really want to focus, hyper fixate on this team being a World Series winner. I want them to win, obviously. I'm going to enjoy the journey because there's a bunch of new guys and there's all these different things. But I am a little concerned for me as a viewer and for maybe even some of those guys on the team that pressure has ramped up a little bit. And two is that not everybody's the same, right? Not everybody needs the exact same style of coaching. You know this from being the head of a show for a really long time. And so you kind of have to work with different people in different ways. And I wonder if the best thing for Vladdy, and I'm not even saying that this is the actual case. This is something that I will find out throughout the year. But is the best case scenario for Vladdy that what he needs in an environment is something that is a bunch of hardos who are hyper serious all the time and that he doesn't feel as though he can just kind of always be himself? Because I thought that he took a major step with his professionalism when he started to like readjust his body. And yeah. Now he's like in this place where like he readjusts the body and he starts to look amazing. And everyone says, well, that was it. See, you figured it out. This yeah. next sort of thing, when you're talking about pitch identification and what to swing at and when he's gone through slumps, it has oftentimes for me on the outside looking at it felt like a lot of it was psychological. And so there's a bit of a building storyline for me anyways that maybe I'm creating. Okay, so I'm acknowledging this of if he doesn't have that other jump, did they potentially screw it up a little bit by making this a less enjoyable experience for him and tightening it up a little bit too much for him?
I think that we saw the baseline for him, right? Like, baseline is a good player. Like, I don't think you're ever going to see a season worse than an 800 OPS for this guy. I think you can only see improvements from there. The other thing that it plays into it, too, is, you know, this guy is going to have a decision about where he plays, and it's not just the money that the Blue Jays decide to offer him. Yeah, maybe if he doesn't enjoy the environment, I suppose that could play into it. Ultimately,
if he has another good year, he's getting paid, I think, this offseason. Like, that's
yeah,
my prediction.
But he
can
decide.
I don't see any way around it.
He's going to get paid anywhere, right?
Yeah,
and he can decide to turn down the Blue Jays' money if he wants. If he's like, yeah, you traded away my best buds, and we didn't reach the heights that we thought we would, and now I have to be Mr. Super Serious and wear a tie, and that stinks. And I don't like that so much. Ultimately, I think so much of this is talking around the point that, yeah, this guy just needs to be super serious in his preparation, which there's no indication that he hasn't been, and that he needs to figure out what it was two seasons ago that unlocked him offensively. I know that's the talking point, because you got to talk about something. Like, how are we going to improve one year to the next after winning 92 games? Like, and it's a maturity thing, and yeah, for all the reasons that I laid out, you can make that case. It's a like maybe 1% of the Vlad story, I think, in 2023.
All right. I think it's a bigger one. And maybe I'm just, again, I'm willing to accept that I might be overdoing this one.
The biggest thing for him, I think, and if you're going to go down the psychological path, is that, and he's talked about this as well, like feeling like he needed to be the guy that lifted this team offensively last year, coming off the recognition that he got in 2021. What could really help that, alleviate it? Actually, there's twofold. One is like Bo Bichette not waiting until September to resurrect his season, like getting off to a good start so that it's not just Vlad that has to be the centerpiece of an offense. And the other is like Brandon Belt against righties looking like he did a couple of years ago. This is not like ancient history that this guy has been an effective major leaguer, middle of the order bat. If there are, and the rest of the guys do their thing offensively and George Springer staying healthy. But yeah, this team creating offense outside of Vlad Jr. is that, you know, that he can relax and not worry about, hey, I take a walk in an RBI situation, there's our run scoring opportunities, feeling like somebody else is going to knock him in.
Don't you feel like this offense is worse though?
Yeah,
it's more balanced, but it's not as powerful. Oh. It's not as potent. And so,
yeah,
like, to me, if it's like, if we're playing that card, it feels like, yeah, no, there's actually more pressure on his shoulders to produce offensively.
Well, I don't think there's any debate that, yeah, the lineup is worse when you substitute Teoscar Hernandez and Lourdes Gurriel Jr. for Kevin Kiermaier and Dalton Varsho, who I like a lot. But yeah, this is a guy with like a 300-ish OPS, and he hits a bunch of bombs, but he's essentially a nothing against left-handed pitching, so you're going to have to mix and match there. And if he's in the lineup against lefties, if Kevin Kiermaier's in the lineup against lefties, like that's some big black holes at the bottom of your order. And maybe instead of them being in the lineup, it's like, you know, Santiago Espinal getting a start at second base and Whit Merrifield moving to the outfield, which isn't exactly super encouraging. No, this team offensively took a step backwards to take a step forwards defensively. But I think, Bo Bichette, do you remember how poorly Bo Bichette played offensively at the beginning of the season last year?
Yes,
I mean, he was knocked down to seventh.
Yes. Ultimately, though, Bo's numbers ended up being like the same, right? And so over the course of the season, he got so red hot, I think it does balance out a little bit. But yeah, I think Varsho's OPS last year was 735. So
which is above average.
Sure. My point here is not like, hey, Dalton Varsho stinks. My point here is that it's a pretty significant step back offensively from what Teoscar Hernandez can do, like a silver slugger, and what Lourdes Gurriel Jr. can be. And yeah, especially when you factor in Kevin Kiermaier. And it's not that I actually like this baseball team, and I want to talk to you about a little bit some of like the rule changes stuff and how I think it impacts this group. I think they're going to try to steal a lot more bases this year. John Schneider, that's more his managerial style. The bases are bigger. They got faster as a team. Blah, 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 blah. They'll be more creative in the way that they score runs. The ballpark dimensions have changed. They've got more left-handed hitting, more balance in the lineup. Like, there's lots of reasons to believe the offense is still going to be very, very, very good. But yeah, to me, actually, it does feel like there's a lot of pressure because some of those guys, if they're not upticking their offense right away, you look through the rest of the lineup and go, okay, George Springer has to stay healthy. Well, he hasn't. Brandon Belt has to stay healthy, and he has to be a positive regression candidate to like a pretty extreme degree. Yeah, there's a lot of things that, from a psychological standpoint, are pointing towards like a lot of pressure on Vladdy and the idea of like quote unquote, and I like the next step branding. Like, of course, who doesn't want that? The Blue Jays should be taking the next step. I don't want them to be thinking, hey, let's just get to the playoffs again. They've done that. You should always be trying to build on it. Success isn't always linear, but who cares? That's sports. The expectation is to win. My only point is with this is like so much of this offseason seems to be geared around the idea of the Blue Jays becoming a more mature baseball team and more pressure on Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And it is going to be kind of curious to see how he responds to this.
Yeah, that shouldn't be I haven't heard them say that explicitly. Like, we need this guy.
But that's
to
the messaging uptick all around everything, right?
Yeah. And to me, playing amateur psychologist, that would be the opposite of the message that I'm trying to convey to a guy who, like I said, I think if you were analyzing what went wrong from last year, was pressing at times and trying to create something out of nothing. And we all remember the Gerrit Cole multiple homer game where he was just hitting everything over the fence or off the fence. Didn't matter if it was on the black or even off the black, and maybe the worst thing that ever happened to him, because you have a game like that and you think, well, why would I ever take a walk when I can do that? And obviously you can't over the course of a 162 game regular season. But I mean, the point is valid about, hey, if you were trying to take some offensive pressure off the linchpin of your offense, getting worse 1-9 in the overall offensively, probably not the best course of action. And it's
well, like,
possible
how does,
that...
Yeah, the defense helps the team, and the defense is good.
Yeah.
Like, we've already done all the numbers and the look at how many runs saved this could potentially have.
That
impact.
Takes pressure off. Is like when your pitchers are only giving up one run a game. There you go.
Yeah.
That's how you do it. That's how you take the pressure off. You don't need many runs.
All right. I didn't plan on going this long with Vladdy or the psychological stuff. Again, I realize that there's probably some listeners listening to this and going, what the hell are you talking about? This is like way too deep. Just tell me about about how the base is being bigger or the pitch clock is going to affect guys. So sorry for that. Anyways, let's take a quick break. Let's come back. And I want to talk to you about two things from the rule changes that I didn't really realize until very recently. And how it might impact the status of the other thing I mentioned to you, which is the future of one of the players on the team. Quick break. Good Hour continues.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, Benny boy. Last block before I send you back to taking care of the young fellas and supervising them playing video games. You guys have one whole chore on the agenda today, shovel the snow, in which you'll just make the young minions. Your driveway's tiny, so that'll take like 2 seconds. And then the minions will do it. How's that rude? It's a fact.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, it's a bigger driveway than the driveway we used to have, which wasn't even a driveway. True. Now I upgraded from no driveway to a driveway, bigger than your driveway, too. Nice.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. It's way bigger than my driveway. Although, every once in a while, I shovel the walk at my building. No big deal.
Why do you do
kind
that?
Of a community hero. Well, because if it snows and the building attendant doesn't take care of it right away, I'll do it. It takes 2 seconds. Like,
that's very nice.
You throw a little bit of salt down and you shovel a little bit of snow, and it makes your day and everybody else's day much easier. It takes like two seconds.
Do people in your building know you by name? Do they like?
Yeah,
you know,
course.
Is it like that Seinfeld episode where everybody, you know, like JD, and you nod and you know their names, and you guys have like a little quick little chat before you go up to your apartments?
Yeah. I've got basically two neighbors who have been here for a while that know me, like that know me by name, and then there's a couple people who haven't been in the building as long. But yeah, the people who you know is actually who you're more afraid of seeing, because there's nothing but awkward chit chat. Like, you've lived now in the same building for years and you've never done any social activity. You've never stepped outside. Like, I've never done anything with these people. I've never been in their apartments, whatever. And so when you get caught in the chit chat, you have to do the, oh, how are you? And that sucks. There's nothing. To me, I would say that my least favorite thing is small talk. You would think that because I do a radio show, podcast, whatever,
you like
that
people,
that actually
generally
interests me. It's like, what?
And you like people too. Like,
yeah, but I like people and hearing out what they like. And that's why sports is so great, is you get to sit down with someone and they're already actively, you know, they're in the pursuit of their leisure activity. So they're open and they're interested and they want to shoot it, and it's simple, it's easy to talk about, it's not complicated, it's fun. And then you can branch off into the other subjects. Doing the small talk routine with your neighbor is hell on earth. Like, that is beyond the worst thing. Oh, how's your dog? Like, I care. I'm sorry. It's cute. That's it. Let's keep it moving. And then you do the, can I walk away from you thing now? Like, I hate that. That actually gives me social anxiety.
Knowing when to walk away is tough.
Oh, God. Who goes first? And are you
holding
them up?
And, like, do you say something? Do you say, like, all right? Like, that's...
I just usually say, like...
is more awkward than just, like, the loud, all right, and see you later.
Yeah.
Big gulps, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Even talking about it right now, it's giving me the heebie-jeebies. I got to shake my wrist out because it's such an awful thing. And it's such a Toronto thing that used to bother me at the very beginning, where I went, how do I not know these people? And when I first moved in, I tried to offer, you know, people whatever, coming up and having a drink or whatever. I was trying to ingratiate myself to the neighbor. And then it was very much like, we don't do that here. What are you doing? So, that's the end of that. So, okay, Blue Jays, keeping with it. Spring stories. One has been, to me, the psychological approach and what that means. And, being smarter on the base paths, making fewer defensive mistakes, tightening up around the edges, you know, trying to draw more walks and show more plate discipline, blah, 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 blah. That's always the spring training stuff. Guys being in the best shape of their lives, showing up in a more professional manner, more professional air around camp, whatever. Matt Chapman spoke the other day. It was to Gregor Chisholm. I talked about this a little bit, but he's going to be 31 in a month. Mm-hmm. He's crucially important to this team. Do you know where he ranked in Fangraphs WAR for the Blue Jays last year?
Well, he was under 4. They had a bunch of guys that were around 4, but I think he was like 3.5. So I would say 5.
He was 3rd.
Okay.
He was 3rd on the team in Fangraphs WAR. There's no, like, or there's at least shifting rules now, which you gotta hope are somewhat helpful. right? Like that does put a little bit of added impetus on defense for him, right? And for this Blue Jays team that really does want to have defense. If we're talking about like the maturity element of it and just the, yeah, all the things that this team sort of wants to have, he really embodies a lot of them. And yet I can't help but feel like there's no succession plan in place. This offseason is completely dead when it comes to third baseman. Like, there's Manny Machado, there's Matt Chapman, and then there's nothing really else. I'm just curious, like, what you think this year is going to bring for Matt Chapman, whether you think there's going to be pressure from the fan base to re-sign him, and whether this team flat out, like, can re-sign a guy that'll be 32 years old come next baseball season.
No, I don't think they can re-sign a guy that's going into, yeah, he's going to be into his mid-30s signing what he hopes is like at least a five-year deal. And his agent is Scott Boras, and he strikes out 200 times a season, which is, yeah, it's part of the Matt Chapman thing, and he walks a bunch, and he hits some home runs, and he plays great defense. But no, there is no world in which I'm shelling out, what, I don't know, close to $30 million a season, like $100 million for Matt Chapman. No offense, Matt Chapman. And I know the defense is good, and, you know, that WAR number doesn't necessarily represent even how valuable he was last year, because the defensive metrics were weird, and if you saw him all season, you understood his value.
He also started slow offensively, too. Like, he was another guy who really struggled early out of the gate.
Although, you look at the season-ending numbers, and the WAR total, I think, was exactly the same as his last season in Oakland, so I kind of think that might be what Matt Chapman is. And remember the conversation when they traded for him, it was like, hey, here's the baseline. If he just does that, what a valuable add. But there's reason to believe he's more than that. Might not be as much reason to believe that he's like going to be a top 10 MVP candidate again, which he was twice in Oakland. Like, and especially now, yeah, as the years continue to pile on, he's a guy you're happy to have. And like you said, there's no obvious solution. You hope one presents itself, though, this year in the form of Addison Barger, who's going to be, I think, along with Ricky Tiedemann, the story of spring training, a guy that's really risen through the minor leagues the last couple of years, got as high as AAA last year, and in limited sample in Buffalo, hit the cover off the ball, went to the Arizona Fall League, didn't do nearly as well, but he's a left-handed hitter. He's got walkability. He's got lots of power, hit almost 30 home runs in the minor leagues, and by all accounts has like a crazy good arm for an infielder.
Yeah,
so third base
in
is
the
not
outfield apparently.
Yep, he's there. There's the possibility exists that they can move him to the outfield as well. But yeah, he's played shortstop, he's played second base, he's played some first base, and he's played some third base. And I'm sure the Blue Jays would love for him to continue the progression and start again in AAA and continue to put up big numbers and at some point be maybe a factor off the bench or maybe as a utility player this season, maybe even as a second baseman. We'll see if like Whit Merrifield is what he was at the end of last year, because he was pretty like all-star Whit Merrifield, and then I mean, you know, the rule changes maybe allows him to get back to the stolen base stuff that we've seen throughout his career, where he led the American League three times.
Oh, he's definitely stealing bases more. Like, it's John Schneider's team, and if they're going to be playing Whit Merrifield more, he's going to have to do that. The only thing about the Addison Barger thing is, okay, great, I hope he turns out to be an awesome player, but saying that you're grooming a 23-year-old complete question mark to be the replacement for Matt Chapman, yeah, the third guy on your team in WAR, when you're saying that it's about the next step, those two things are in direct conflict with one another. And here's the other thing that I didn't know up until yesterday. You know who the most adversely affected Blue Jays were against the shift last year?
Against the shift? I mean, they're all right-handed hitters, so I mean, even the most adversely affected probably wasn't all that adversely affected, unless it's Calamino.
They were, actually, because Matt Chapman only OPS'd 597 against the shift last year. He was dreadful against it. And so, yeah, I'm kind of curious like whether we see a bit of an uptick from his offensive numbers and if he's actually better this year. Like, maybe it happens. What happens if Matt Chapman's awesome and his defense looks great and he's hitting the ball and he's just like one of the clubhouse leaders and he's one of the faces of, quote-unquote, the next step? How are you going to be able to say that we're walking away from this guy, we're moving off of this guy without a better plan in place than, oh, what, shifting Santiago Espinal over to third base? Addison Barger as the 24-year-old who's going to step in for him next to Bo Bichette in what will be, again, a season that you're expecting to win. It's a weird – it's a very weird and complicated one because Semien was always a rental, right? It was always, hey, he's here to increase his value, and then he's going to move on. He's going to get a massive deal. They're not at that point. They are kind of now the Blue Jays in a spot where – maybe the retention has to happen with this roster. Like, maybe this is sort of the signing they have that they equate to what the Leafs did with Jake Muzzin, where you acquire a guy through a trade who's supposed to be everything that you need, and you know that his second contract is not going to finish well. Like, I'm not saying that you know it's necessarily going to finish with an injury like Muzzin seems to be, but that, yeah, even though you know that this is not going to end up as being a solid thing, and even though you know that you have other contracts coming down the line, you might just have to do this from a roster standpoint because there's just no other way of replacing this guy.
Yeah, I mean, if Addison Barger stinks and Matt Chapman OPS is 950, yes, then you're in a conundrum if he plays 162 games and is that top 10 MVP guy.
But
again,
that's,
like,
you're
I'm not
crazy about the bar now, like, because actually, if he's gone, someone's going to pay him crazy, crazy money. I'm saying if so he's if just he, him again this year, like if he just maintains who he is, maybe a little bit better.
I still think you move on. Like, I don't think you pay that guy. I really don't. I don't think, especially with the massive contracts that are upcoming, if you plan on retaining Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and a team that's already into the top six in luxury tax payroll, and I know the Hyunjin Ryu contract coming off the books, but yeah, you got money sunk into a 30-year-old outfielder in George Springer, and then you got an Alek Manoah contract that needs to be signed at some point as well. I don't think necessarily that's good business to hitch your wagon to Matt Chapman, as valuable as he has been, mostly on the strength of defense, understanding that, yeah, the offense can be better and has been throughout the course of his career. I mean, maybe it's not Addison Barger, maybe it's a trade, but yeah, the idea of a Matt Chapman on the 2024 Blue Jays is kind of a hard one for my brain to go to. Again, like, we're talking about Scott Boras here, who's like, you're not going to get a discount unless you're a pitcher and there's a real risk of injury, like what happened with Steven Strasburg and the Washington Nationals. No, that guy's going to free agency as long as he's healthy and performing.
Dude, 100%. I'm not trying to outline, it's foolish for anybody to say he's going to give a hometown discount or that's even going to be a point of conversation with this team. Like, Matt Chapman is going to be in his 30s, and he's out of his arb years. He wants to get paid. And quotes about guys liking Toronto, I'd love to see the list of athletes who are free agents living in the city going into their walk year, saying they like it here and their family likes it. All those different quote cliches that we end up getting. And then, of course, they leave. Like, you know else liked it here? Ross Stripling, a lot.
Oh, I loved it.
He loved it here. It's like, he's gone. And again, he probably would have resigned. I'm not saying Matt Chapman wouldn't, but he would have resigned
Marcus
if the money was
Stroman
right.
Got a tattoo of the city skyline, and that wasn't his choice to depart,
exactly. That's not his choice. But either way, my only point here is that clearly he's going to get paid. I wonder if that they're at that time in their competitive cycle, like the Leafs were with Muzzin, where you decide as an organization, we have to sign a contract that is going to end up being bad, because the alternative is taking a step back competitively, and there's just no other way around it. And that's a real inflection point for me. Like I said, Semien wasn't. Basically, they've had no guy that's walked in free agency so far that I've gone, oh, okay. And even this past offseason when they were trying to sound an outfielders, and they went after Nimmo, and then Nimmo's price went up to that crazy height, and you went, okay, well, no, you can't do that. But that's because you could find other ways to clean up your outfield. I don't know how the trade works if you don't have a ton of prospect capital available to you, because at this point, they don't. They desperately need Ricky Tiedemann. I'm sure there are other things in the organization that will improve and grow and become possible for other baseball teams. There's other ways of being creative about it. Maybe it is a different guy from the roster. Like, again, this isn't an impossibility. It's a problem from a year from now. But if we're looking at free agent options for next year to fill that hole, there's only one. It's Matt Chapman.
Yep. Or it's Manny Machado if you want to absolutely absolutely nuts.
I'm done doing this. I'm done doing this. Like, after they didn't even talk to Carlos Correa when his value was, like, plummeting, and they didn't even take a phone call with him, I went, okay, I'm done pretending this. I'm done doing the runner-up thing.
But they've done the thing that you outlined, right? Like, they've done the Jake Muzzin thing. They did it with Hyunjin Ryu, understanding that they gave him the fourth year.
Different timeline. Different timeline. They had nothing else on the books then, Ben. There was no money.
Yep.
They had to hit that cap floor. Like, you know, I know there's no cap. Thank you. I'm just saying. I knew you were going to nerd out on baseball. That's why I went and said that right afterwards, and I qualified it. But no, he's the first guy where in the competitive cycle, they have to make that hard decision of, do we give the bad contract because we need to win?
Well, the Springer deal is probably not going to look good by the end of it.
Different timeline. You signed George Springer at the beginning of when you wanted to be competitive, and you knew that a large portion of that contract was not going to line up with when those stars were going to be getting paid. That was a far, far, far down the line problem. You're paying Matt Chapman now, like let's say next offseason, that could be the same offseason that you're getting the cost certainty of whatever the hell you have to play Vladdy. That could be the offseason where, well, maybe they probably won't pay Manoa, right? They'll probably let a pitcher go until the end of his contract, or at least closer to. But yeah, you've got those things looming, and you're right in the middle of the competitive cycle. I do think that there is a very, very different feel to the Chapman one than to every other free agent signing that they've had in, you know, this iteration with this group, with this front office.
What, you think it's more likely that they give him, again, 5-year,
I'm talking myself into it a little bit more. I got to tell you, I am. Yeah. Like, I feel like, how many years of the Chapman deal do you think they have to think are going to end up being good ones for them to sign a 5-year contract?
I would say, so what did we say with the Ryu one? We said two years, it was like one and a half of the 4 years. I would say if you're signing him to a 5-year deal until he's like 37, that you want to get 3 good years out of that thing, which would take you into the Vlad and Bo free agency. The idea of getting that out of 35-year-old Matt Chapman, again, a guy who has huge swing and miss, and I know the thing that ages best in baseball is your eye and your ability to walk, but not when you literally cannot make contact, which he can make enough of and has the power to entice pitchers occasionally into the zone. Yeah, the offense scares me a little bit that we didn't see an uptick like I might have expected after he left the cavernous ballpark in Oakland and went to Rogers Center to play on a team with a good lineup in some ballparks that are actually advantageous to hitters. I didn't see necessarily what I would have liked to have seen offensively. Now, if he gets off to a better start this year, maybe we get back to that and you can convince me, but there's just a little too swing and miss for a guy who's going to be into his mid-30s.
I'm just Googled Athletics third baseman, because that's basically this team's building plan at that position, is they just go, hey, who can we trade for? Right. That is, unfortunately, their third baseman is a 22-year-old now, so it's a little bit too early. So yeah, they're screwed. If you present me with the option of, hey, what does the third baseman replacement look like? Sure. I'm just having a really tough time, like I said, seeing what that could be in free agency. They don't appear to be able to make that work internally. No offense to Addison Barger. Prove me wrong. No. Go ahead. But this is a classic Ben Ennis spring training take is over.
Hey, buddy, I was about to mention Aurelvis Martinez might factor in as a potential third baseman of the future in 2024 as well.
Yeah. Again, if you are trying to win a World Series and Aurelvis Martinez is where you're turning for your hot corner, his first year at the position full-time at age what, sorry?
Yeah, 22, maybe.
In his first Major League Baseball season? Again, I don't know how that fits with the messaging of next step. Like, next step can't just be a message to the players. If you're going to do next step, my only point here is you've also got to have that same messaging go up to the front office, and I really do think that the next step from them, from a contractual standpoint, is to do the deal that is obviously bad on the back end, which all free agency deals are, but do that one when you know you're going to have to pay your superstars, because that's a completely different thing.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, we were talking about 2024, and so much can change over the course of a year. Like, if they win a World Series this year and Matt Chapman wins World Series MVP, sure. Give him $200 million.
Yes.
Who cares?
Fine. Okay. Yes. You ruined it. Thank you. Thanks. You ruined it with the most extreme of hypotheticals in the other way. Anyways, I like Matt Chapman. And if somebody can present me with a better option, sure. But if that's a trade, great. If someone comes available. But if we're trying to do this whole thing of like lining up guys, trying to find the third baseman who's good, who can play for the Blue Jays next season and who's in his mid to late 20s and on a controllable contract, that's going to cost you a lot. And I'm not really sure that the Blue Jays have that as of today. So unless they end up having some breakthrough candidates in their farm system and they want to continue to pull from that, then
Barker,
it might just have to be that. Ben Ennis, again, go, oh, I'm not going to play the video games with my sons. They're going to do it all. Yeah, anyways, have fun.
No, they're already too good.
While like, I work.
Yeah, so they're playing the Super Smash Bros., which I only just downloaded for them on the weekend. Mm-hmm. And my eldest son the other day was like, we just got a notification. We played 100 of these games, which is it's been like, you know, 4 days that they've been playing this game.
What's crazy is you take your kids outside. Like, you're very active with your boys. I can only imagine what, you know, other kids are doing on the video game systems at that age. Yeah. Anyways, Ben Ennis, Fan Drive later today. We'll be listening to you then. Quick break. We'll come back. I've got Richie Larea in the next hour. Are people going to care more about TFC because of the World Cup run? That's next. All right, I hope some of you are listening live to this at your work from home desks. Shout out to anybody who's on the road today. Be safe. I know it's not snow day for all the adults. Okay, so a couple of things I want to touch on before I get to this Richie Larea interview. Number one, we got an announcement on Jake Muzzin yesterday, and he's out for the season, and that includes the playoffs with a cervical spine injury, which is incredibly scary stuff. And I know that it sometimes feels weird to have to preface these things, but I'll do it anyways. Clearly, people are just hoping Jake Muzzin recovers. And yes, obviously, his playing career is secondary, but as it relates to the Toronto Maple Leafs, there are a couple of things here. There are some trickle-down effects that made me think yesterday. Okay, so number one is Leafs have already used most of his cap space with call-ups and acquiring the $3 million in salary on the books for Achari and Ryan O'Reilly, right? So for those of you that were just kind of curious of, okay, well, what does this mean in terms of the trade deadline? If they're acquiring somebody, especially anybody of significance, it looks like a roster player has to go out. That's just the way that it is. Somebody's going to have to move, and they can get creative if it's a really cheap salary in terms of some of the guys that are basically AHLers anyways, ending up getting sent down. But they also have to incorporate Matt Murray's contract back into the mix here at some point. Because I don't think Matt Murray is going to be on LTIR until the postseason, and they're going to try to break him out of the carbonite and throw him out there for the most important games in... God, I hate how we do this over and over every single year. These are the most important games. But yeah, these ones are the most important, okay? The GM doesn't have a contract. There's one more year left after this on Matthews and Nylander. Tavares is going to be 33 years old. Ryan O'Reilly's a free agent. Like, yeah, there's a lot going on, okay? So it's very, very, very important that this team breaks through in the postseason this year. I think we all know it. The fan base is frustrated, blah, 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 blah. Anyways, the cap space is used. That's not a thing. I've had people ask me about it. It's already done. But here's the actual other side of this. His loss for the season, and just having it be official, even though we all really knew, and this is something that basically when the injury first happened, I was texting with people that were telling me, yeah, he's done for the year. Like, it's more about his career at this point than it is about this season. Having it down on paper and thinking about Jake Muzzin, it did serve as a bit of a reminder to me about why this team went out and got him. Part of it was pedigree. He was a pedigree player that really was a need for this team. He's a great guy in the room to the degree where the players are still talking about him like, hey, he's still very important to us. There was a good article by Jonas Siegel that I read this morning about how Muzzin still travels with the team. He's still working out with the guys. And it's actually nice to hear that he's healthy enough to be able to even just enjoy playing a little bit of virtual golf with Mitch Marner, like doing the little things. So at least he's like moving around and he's doing okay. This is a he can't play hockey thing right now. So they went out and got him for that. And now they've got a lot of that in their room, right? Achari's been to a finals. Ryan O'Reilly is a Conn Smythe winner. Matt Murray has won 2 Stanley Cups. They've got more of that in the room than they've had before. And yeah, having Jake Muzzin around for that team probably matters. These guys have been through a lot of battles together now, whatever, even though it hasn't been out of the first round. Like, they're an experienced playoff group. They're going to know what to expect. And hopefully having somebody like O'Reilly and someone like Achari, those two guys getting them in here, that only adds to the confidence of this group when they're in tight and maybe they look around the room. I've always said, do things feel the same? I don't think that they will when you see a big bearded, toothless guy who has hoisted the Stanley Cup trophy over his head as a captain. Okay, so they've shored some of that up. But the other reasons why they got Jake Muzzin was reliable shutdown defenseman. Okay, that's been somewhat replaced by TJ Brody. Okay, got that one. The other was that physical presence in the snarl. He was the guy on their blue line that was going to throw a big hit. He was going to be the guy that went in the corner and won a puck battle and used his size to his advantage. And it sucks because probably a lot of the reason why Jake Muzzin's body wore down is because he was such a physical player. And this is what comes with that. That's the part of it that, yeah, hurts to think about, was how many postseasons they missed him because they needed that style from him. And when he would have to push it in those big moments, it would really hurt him. And then he ended up getting knocked out, and it's always been a question for so many of these playoff runs. Is like, well, what if they would have had a healthy Jake Muzzin, right? It still feels like they're missing that. Some people will argue, and they'll say that's not really important, and they're never going to be able to change their identity of their team or whatever, blah, 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 blah. But heading into the trade deadline, so like heading into this weekend, this is kind of my parting Leaf thought, is I still think it's important they find a little bit of that thump on the back end. They find that guy who can deliver a big hit and that guy who can play some big minutes for them, whether it be on the penalty kill or whatever. I'd like another buffer between Morgan Rielly and the penalty kill. I think the Leafs need another big body who can go into those corners and inspire some confidence, who can move somebody in front of the net and, yeah, crunch them when they try and get cute. So yeah, they're still missing his snarl. And I look at 32 Thoughts yesterday. I read Elliott's piece, and I look at, I think it was Luke Fox, I want to get this right, about who outlined the top 33 free agents. No, it was Rory Boylan, who's also excellent. Rory Boylan for Sportsnet, he's got a piece up, you know, examining 30 potential trade candidates. Elliott did his 32 Thoughts. I've been basically reading every single piece of, I don't know, rumor mill material that you can possibly get your hands on, trying to find out whether or not there's a fit for the Leafs. And for a really long time, I thought it was going to be Luke Shen. But based on what the insiders like Elliott are saying, he appears to be out of the price range of the Toronto Maple Leafs. That's how coveted and that's how thin the market is for guys that bring what he does. I think Shen would be perfect. There's, you know, a tidy narrative for somebody like me who trades in it that is kind of fun. But from a physical postseason pedigree, actually still can play the game standpoint, he really fits for me. Looks too expensive. There's not going to be the Matt Dumbas of the world. That's gone. Gavrikov was, I think, not always a pipe dream, because had Toronto not made the Ryan O'Reilly trade, they obviously could have been in on that. But yeah, it thins out. It thins out really, really fast, and especially when you consider this is the NHL and some of these teams are not going to, they're not going to decide to move out of the playoff mix. If they're still in it, they're going to try to take their shot. They're going to try to move there. Like, that's the situation Detroit finds themselves in right now, where everyone was starting to put a couple of their guys into the rumor mill, and now it feels like, maybe not. Maybe those guys are actually just going to stay put in Detroit and they're going to try to work on keeping them as a part of their group. Anyway, this Dubas has already, to me, done a terrific job at the deadline getting Achari and Ryan O'Reilly. The price was steep, but guess what? That's the prices. The price is the price. They went out and got two guys that this team desperately needed in a year where they desperately need to win. And I think we've all seen the results so far are pretty indicative of how these guys can change the ceiling of this team. But if there's one other piece of business to be done, it is trying to find not the Muzzin replacement fully. Again, they've already done pieces of that with TJ Brody. It's, can you find that little bit of nastiness on your blue line at a price that works for you and for a player who can actually justifiably get into your lineup? That's why maybe they should take a little bit of a look at Jordy Benn and see if he's that, but I don't think he is. As much as I like Jordy and as much as I think a lot of us root for him, maybe you take a little bit of a look. But to me, this group has to, again, insulate themselves better on the penalty kill, and I don't think that they want to have Rasmus Sandin or Connor Timmins playing in the postseason as much as – some of the numbers might indicate it's better off if they do than the type of guy that I'm talking about. Anyways, I talked to Richie Larea. We caught up yesterday. I taped this one. So I'll throw to it in a second. My only point of curiosity with this, like with this TFC season, because we mostly talked about Canada soccer, looking back on some of the fun of the run and the future of Canada soccer and the next World Cup, all, at Richie's playing style, all that stuff. Great guy. Like, really enjoyed talking to him. He's truly one of my favorite players. TFC starts on Saturday. And it's not going to – soccer is, in this country is not going to pick up in the middle of trade deadline season. Like, that's obvious. That's obvious, obvious, obvious. The Raptors are also going to have a ton of intrigue, right, because they've got to make a postseason push of their own. And I think that there is going to be a lot of debate and discussion about whether or not they made the right decision at the deadline. Like, that's not going away until the offseason is passed. And then, well, not even then. It's going to end up going beyond that. But, yeah, it's been muted. Blue Jays are going to be in spring training. TFC always faces an uphill battle from the standpoint of, like, trying to get the non-diehards to focus in on the team. People like me. It's hard for me to have conversations about it. People ask me, like, JD, why don't you talk more about TFC? And I go, because I don't think a lot of people end up having conversations about TFC. And if, you know, the people who are, you'd rather hear from them. You'd rather hear from the people who have tracked this team from its inception and not the guys who kind of fly in and check in every once in a while. But my point of curiosity here is, like, always about momentum, right? Like, we usually over exaggerate it when it comes to Olympics and whether or not that creates more interest in sports. Like, I don't think that building these extremely expensive multiplexes where you can go to a velodrome now after the Olympics, like, that ever does anything. There's, like, study after study that prove, like, no, they're not the case. But Canada's men's soccer team being in the World Cup and having some of those guys be members of TFC, that does feel a little different. And all the people that had to watch those soccer games now and went, that looks like a really enjoyable fan experience. I'd like to be a part of something like that. And knowing that a World Cup is 4 years away and that it is to be in this country, whether or not there's just a little bit more motivation for the casual sports viewer, a person who's listening to the show and who frankly doesn't give a crap about TFC, to go, yeah, actually, I'd like to make it down to BMO for a game this year. Maybe two. Maybe I will watch a game on television and not just through a gambling aspect, like actually sit there and watch it with real intrigue. Anyway, does that momentum pan out, or is that nothing for this league? Are they completely disconnected from one another and we're just that still, where Canada as a soccer country is still the people who love it? They're the people who love the EPL. It's got a huge audience here. Soccer is still massive here. But does it start to draw in a few more casuals? Do we see a World Cup bump for the team that's in our city? Anyway, I spoke to Richie Larea yesterday. Here it is. Very excited to be joined by one of my favorites, member of the Canadian men's national team and TFC. It's Richie Larea. Bro, it's great to have you.
Nice. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to speak to you guys.
Yeah, man. Okay, so I'm sure, like, yeah, you're there, you're training, the season's right around the corner. Let's just start with that, man. How you feeling? Like, how's the health? How are you feeling about this year's TFC team?
Yeah, I feel healthy. I feel good. Obviously ready for the season to kick off this weekend. I think it's been a long time coming, especially, you know, with how long ago the season ended for us last year. I think it's, you know, nice. It's a great opportunity for us to move forward and, you know, get games going, playing this for this massive club and beautiful city. So, yeah, everything on that front's good. And, yeah, I think all the guys on the team are ready to roll and are, I think, share similar opinions as me as they're ready for the season to get going. You know, it's been a long break and, you know, preseason is preseason and people are just ready for the real games to start. So,
yeah, man, I imagine that's especially the case for you because, yeah, you're just a hard competitor. I get the sense that, yeah, you're not as much of a practice guy as a games guy.
Yeah, the games are definitely a lot better for me. You know, I don't want to take out my I don't want to be taking out teammates. So I'd rather take out the games to get going.
I was going to say, I bet you, like, yeah, you're probably at the point now, like, the closer it gets to the season, the more your teammates are like, Richie, please, man, relax.
Yeah, it is funny, actually. In training, whenever we do it and I'm going up against Lorenzo, he actually comes to me, he's like, are you taking it easy today? Or are you going full throttle? You know, so it's funny. So yeah, it'll definitely be good once it'll definitely be good to get the games going so we're competing against other guys that isn't going. There's a nice feeling around the entire building as well.
Yeah, that's good, man. It's actually something I did want to talk to you about today, though, which is, dude, like, you got that dog in you. Like, that's why you resonate with so many fans, and especially so many new fans who watch Canada soccer for the first time, is like, you know, you're just a competitor, and you basically just have one speed. You're not afraid to mix it up with an opposing player. It's just, it's fun. It's enjoyable to watch, especially in today's sports climate that I think a lot of people, including myself, complain oftentimes about being a little too friendly. I wonder if, like, that part of you think is something that you can teach to somebody, or if that's innate.
Yeah, honestly, I think that's something I've always had since I was younger. You know, I think I was literally just telling this story not too long ago. You know, one of my very first coaches, or my very first coach ever, you know, was, you know, a coach that I had in the Spanish League down in Toronto. And, you know, that was like some of the things he's always, you know, told us and taught us is, you know, play with your heart. You know, when you play, leave everything out there. So I've kind of just brought that with me my entire career, which I'm glad that I have. You know, I think it helps me with my game. Also, I think, like you said, I think here at TFC, and then also I know very much so at the national team, we have a group that is like that, you know, where we, you know, every game we're in it, we're in it for the fight. And I think, you know, someone seeing me do it gets the guy next to me amped to, you know, go make a big play next play, and, you know, just trickles across the entire, you know, the field, right? So, yeah, I do it because it's something I've done since I've been so young, and it's stuck with me. But definitely sometimes it's something I try to do where I can, you know, bring other guys into the game, you know, from, you know, me making, I don't know, a tackle, me making a play, me getting a guy's face, you know, just stuff like that. You know, it gets me going. I feel like it gets guys around me going as well. So it works out well.
Dude, it definitely gets the fans going. Like, I'll tell you right now that I'm in the seats, and I've sat next to people when you start to do it, and people just doing the Richie chance, because it's just, it gets heated. It gets hot, man. So it sounds like then it's just something that, you know, you've always kind of felt you have to hit that gear as a competitor more than it's like a chip on your shoulder kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of both, to be honest. I just think, you know, in this, in my career so far, I've had, you know, people doubt me. I've had things go wrong for me. And, you know, it kind of, you know, when you have that sense of almost losing, I don't know, losing the opportunity of playing football, I don't want to have that feeling, you know what I mean? So as long as I'm able to play and compete, I want to play like this, you know, as if it's going to be my last. So it's, again, I think it's a little bit of both, like what you just said.
Dude, I think that's a good thing, though, because my guess is that guys like you that have that feeling, that intention, and when they go out there and that leave it all out there mentality, those are the guys that finish their careers without regret.
That's one thing I do want to do. I definitely don't want to finish my career with any regrets. And, of course, I hope that's a long way away from now, but I just want to keep pushing it in that direction and keep going, you know, the way I have, plus, you know, even more, you know, there's always room for improvement, always room to do better in some areas. So that's definitely a goal of mine, to, you know, finish my career and be able to sit back and say I, you know, done everything I set out to do. And even if I don't reach every single point, but I know that I've left everything I had and emptied my tank, you know.
Dude, you're only 28, and you just turned 28, so I don't want to pretend like I'm aging you and being like, when you look back on your career, like it's you got a lot of days playing football. Like, you're good, man. You're good. So how much are you feeling right now, too? Like, I imagine when you're saying that you want to get back to playing and that you've been off for some time with the club, you at least had the luxury of being a part of the World Cup and doing the qualifiers. But does that even make you hungrier? Like, I would imagine that coming off the high of that, being in a World Cup, playing on that stage, that to go into training had to be a bit difficult.
Yeah, honestly, for me, like you said, I think you've hit it on the nail on the nose, to be honest. It does make you hungrier, in my opinion, because for me now it's like, all right, you've played in, you know, made it to one World Cup, you've played in one World Cup, get to another one, you know, like you want that feeling of playing against the best teams in the world, competing with the best, you know, showing that you're not far off or you're right there with some of the top guys, you know what I mean? So for me, yeah, it definitely makes you hungry, and I think it just you know, fuels you, really, because it's like, you know, okay, like the minute you exit the tournament, it's like, all right, the next one's 4 years away, and what can I do from this point forward to get back to this exact same position that I'm in now, 4 years from now, you know, when your country is one of the host countries, you know what I mean? So, yeah, there's definitely, I definitely do feel that, and I will put that pressure on myself from now till that time comes around and beyond that, you know, and I think that's how you get better as a player as well. So I'll just continue to, you know, do little things like that in order to continue to push myself. So I'm not sat in this comfortable position, you know. I think being uncomfortable with the profession that I have, maybe not for all, but definitely for me, I think is good. When I'm in those positions, it's when I feel like I grow the most and I learn the most. So that's what I'm going to continue to keep pushing.
Well, that makes sense, man, because like you said, it's so far away. It's probably hard to, you know, think about it and want to have that feeling back, that itch back of like that level of competition, especially since, you know, this program has been dying for that forever. Like, I wasn't born the last time, you weren't either, when the last time when Canada was in the World Cup. And so for you to go from that high into the rest of these things and keeping that in mind, it's good to stay hungry because, yeah, one of my points of curiosity is like, dude, you guys were so awesome during the qualifiers and you could just tell like the intensity of the group was insane. And yeah, I do wonder if you think that changes just a little bit, like, or how it changes knowing that you guys have already booked a spot because we're a host country.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we haven't had to deal with that before, and it's something new that's going to be for the entire group, so I think we're going to have to adapt of not going through the grind of playing the CONCACAF teams to qualify and stuff like that, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think it just, for the group that we have, I have no worries about it, and I just think it brings new challenges for the entire group. You know, now there's no qualifying game. Now it's like, you know, you have to take every window super, super serious because it's a prep for, you know, what's to come. So, yeah, it's nice, and you don't have to go through the graft and the grind of, you know, play in the exact same sentence. You know you're going to a World Cup as a country, so I think you just need to be prepared as best as possible with the game, the friendly matches that are played, the camps that are held. You know, it's all there's not going to be any meaningless moments together as a national team when you're one of the host countries. So I think those moments are going to be key for the group to continue to gel and move forward. So I don't think it should be a problem.
Yeah. Well, again, it's now one of the cool things about Canada soccer is that it's so competitive that like none of you guys can really rest on your laurels. Like, there's no guaranteed spots. And so, yeah, trying to be a part of that next group, I would imagine that intensity is only going to ramp up. Okay, I want to go back to a couple things from the World Cup because, man, it was so incredible. So first things first, when you guys did qualify, what was that night like after the Jamaica game?
Yeah, honestly, incredible, man. It was good, honestly, because I felt like during the game, even after the final whistle, you're celebrating, you're staying there, you're, you know, having drinks with the boys in the locker room after, and you know, all of that stuff's so amazing and so nice, and we have pictures and memories to last a lifetime now about that type of stuff. But I feel like it didn't really hit. Maybe I can only speak for myself, but I feel like I remember a few guys in as well. It didn't really hit me that, you know, that game against Jamaica, beating them at BMO Field in Toronto, where a lot of the guys on the team were born, raised, or spent some time in, that like took us to the World Cup. You know, I didn't really register that. So, and then later on in the evening, you know, when you see everyone's families together and all of that stuff and celebrating it seems a little bit more real. But yeah, the night was surreal, man. We did stuff as a team, which was super nice, and you know, just got to enjoy the night. And it was really only that night, because the next day, you know, we're already back at it, and Don has us out at BMO Field already having a training session, you know what I mean? So it's like, you can, yeah, you're gonna enjoy yourself, but it's you know, there's still another game to be played. So it was kind of nice having it in the middle there and not at the end, because we were able to celebrate just enough and not too much, because we had to focus on on another game.
Yeah, it was the best. It was really, really great. It was, and it was just cold enough to probably keep you guys just like not too rowdy, spilling out into the streets. You know, like it was freezing cold that day. I was like, these poor guys from Jamaica having to come down here. You guys are ramped up to make this like, you know, World Cup. You're finally about to make it, and then it's like freezing cold. I was like, this is insult to injury for those fellas. Okay, looking back on the qualifiers, last qualifier question before World Cup stuff. Who did you guys hate more, Mexico or the States? Because you guys were getting into it with both of those teams, and like both of those teams did not like you guys.
Yeah. Oh man. Honestly, man, I don't even think it was with this group. I don't even know if it was a thing of hate or anything like that. I think for us, it was just like we wanted to go out there, and if we were playing Panama, El Salvador, obviously Mexico and U.S. are the big ones. We just wanted to. With all due respect, just crush these guys, to be honest. Like, that was, like, our mindset. We're like, let's, you know, who cares who they have? Who cares what they've done in the past? Like, this is now, and this is the present. So what they've done before, score lines our previous Canadian generations have had against them don't mean anything, you know? Let's go out there and give it a right go, you know what I mean? And I think that's what we did, so... I felt like every game we almost prepared the exact same, where it's like, you know, in the past, Canada even playing, you know, anyone in CONCACAF, El Salvador, the Panama, stuff like this, like we were deemed going to those games the underdogs, you know what I mean? So now in qualifiers, the way we set ourselves up, we were going into those games and those teams, like, you're looking across and you're like, oh, these guys are scared of us. Like, wow, like, you know, tables have turned, you know, and even when you play the Mexico, you play U.S., you see now these guys are starting to respect the team a lot more versus, you know, the way maybe games used to go against them before, you know, maybe far before some of us were even on the national team, you know. So, yeah, I don't know if I would say, like, there's a team in particular that we're like, ah, like, obviously beating the U.S., those are games that are very important for us as a team and this program because they're top teams and our division in CONCACAF. So to be able to top the all of CONCACAF and, you know, right up into the last window, almost go undefeated is, I think, a testament to what we've done and created with this group of guys, you know what I mean? So that's why I say it's not really in particular. I think that was the biggest thing we did. We never wanted to make it about being better than Mexico or the U.S. We just wanted to be the best in CONCACAF. We wanted to finish first. We wanted to finish undefeated, which we fell short of, but you know, just things like this. So I think we celebrated, you know, wins away at El Salvador the exact same as we celebrated a win in Hamilton against the U.S. You know, just almost we just had the World Cup in mind that we weren't thinking, you know, nearsighted where it was like, oh, we just beat the U.S. Like, we're better than them now. That's not what the mindset was. It was more like, yeah, let's go beat these guys because we are like we feel like we are better than them. We're going to show them that we're better than them, and then we want to finish first and go to the World Cup in style, you know. So that's sort of what you saw, and I think maybe in those games you see a little bit more guys getting into it a little bit more because it's normal, you know. It's top teams playing against each other, and you know, probably weird for Canadians to hear other Canadian players saying that we're a top team, but that's what we are. We're a top team. We finished top in CONCACAF. We're the best team in CONCACAF. So it was us, the best team in CONCACAF, going up against Mexico, and us, the best team in CONCACAF, going to go up against the U.S., you know? So, yeah, they were heavyweight matches, and we were able to come out on top on the games as well. So it was a good moment. Obviously, gives us confidence to be able to be teams with the quality of players that they have as well.
Yeah, it should. And I guess the reason why I tune in or focus in on Mexico and the States is because those are like the teams where you go, okay, they're the guarantees. And Canada's trying to chip in and be around them. And it's like a little bit of a little brother thing. And then all of a sudden you guys are beating them and you're outclassing them in some cases, like especially the like Ice Teca game, you know, the one at Edmonton. And I could just feel it like from through the screen, like the Mexican players were so pissed that you guys were just better. And then the same thing with the States, like the Hamilton game, I was at that one. That was the best because that was when it was like, holy crap, like they're going. It kept feeling like as a fan, like, okay, when is this ride going to end? When is this ride going to become real? And then all of a sudden you guys beat the States. And it was also great because they were complaining a lot, which made it even sweeter, right? Like they were in there, like talking about the whistle and the conditions. I was like, yes, this is the best. Give me all this. Hook it to my veins. But yeah, just sort of the holy crap, their realization that there was another team in CONCACAF that was like at their level and that cycle beyond them. I do think that it rubbed those two groups especially like a little bit differently than some of the other countries.
Yeah, definitely. It did rub them the wrong way. I would agree with that. And, you know, they're both so used to being so dominant with everything and all that stuff. But, you know, seeing us beat them, you know, it's probably a little bit of a disbelief for them. And they probably didn't want to believe it and thought that, like, they should have, should be beating us, whatever it might be. So, yeah, definitely, I think, especially the most important for the Canadian fans, I think those two games, even the away at Nashville tie, even the tie at Azteca, Azteca is, those are big games for the country, you know what I mean? Like, you know.
Huge.
It shows the direction of the program trying to go. So I think more importantly, it gives, you know, Canadian fans and obviously as fans, you want to be able to have, you know, some bragging rights and be able to support your team knowing that they're doing well. So that's also a very good thing and helps us get more fans, helps us get more believers. And, you know, whenever the men's national team plays now, it's, you know, wherever it might be across Canada, just an absolute jam. Stadium, you know, that's what
No, it was. Man, every single time, like, again, I went to three games, and every single one of them was nuts. I was actually, probably the most disappointing one from a fan support was El Salvador. Yeah, El Salvador, I think is who it was. And it just felt more like there was a lot of red and there was a lot of blue, and they had a lot of fan support there, and I was kind of pissed. I was like, this sucks. Why are there so many blue shirts here? And then you guys whooped them, and it basically felt from that point forward, it was just a massive tipping point of like, okay, everybody that's showing up to these games, the support was completely different. And yeah, it really was, I think in terms of my lifetime anyways, one of the coolest sporting moments, one of the coolest runs by any team that I've ever seen. Yeah, really the only thing I can kind of equated to for me anyways was the Raptors championship run. So you guys, you get to the World Cup. Did anything surprise you there? Like, what was the feeling amongst the group? Because yeah, you guys showed very well, and then, you know, the tournament ends up not going obviously the way that you guys wanted to, but like, how did you guys feel about your group when the thing was all said and done? Like, were you surprised by anything? Did you feel like, you know, you showed exactly who you were? Did you feel like, what was the overall sentiment when you came out of it as a group?
Yeah. I mean, I think it just, the performances we had, despite the results, just speaks volumes about the type of group that we have. You know, you see teams go to a World Cup and they're put in difficult groups and they completely change their style of play. And now they start sitting back, bunkering, playing for a tie or playing to score a goal and then sit back again, you know. And those are all things we could have did. And people probably thinking, you know, it's Canada, they haven't been here for 36, you know, maybe sit back and relax and, you know, kind of just enjoy the moment and not really care about the games. But we did the exact opposite. You know, we went into the games, I think, especially in the first game, we surprised the hell out of Belgium. And I didn't see all of them, but I saw a few of the things, their players, even coaches. And even, you know, I bumped into Thierry Henry after the game, and, you know, he was also in disbelief, you know, like, so to see a team like that with the players they have speaking about our group after they beat us, but, like, felt like they shouldn't have beat us, you know, that should have put a smile on every single Canadian fan, player, staff, everyone, anyone that's Canadian should have put a huge smile on their face, because, you know, that's, there's very, like, extremely, extremely top players on that team we played against that have damn near won everything the club game has to offer and competed at high levels internationally as well, speaking like that about a team that hasn't been to the World Cup in 36 years. So to play in the style that we did, although we lost, I think was a big, big starting point for us to start the tournament. Obviously, a win would have been perfect. But even to lose but to play the way we played, I think we put a lot of people on notice, which was, you know, you lose what you hate, but then, like, hindsight, you look at it and you're like, oh, okay, like, at least, you know, people are starting to give us our respect, you know. And then same thing, we play Croatia, we go up 1-0, mm-hmm. and then we're kind of, like, in the mix and battling it with them as well, and we're playing against a team that had just the previous World Cup were runners up, you know. So it's, you know, these aren't easy games, and we're able, you know, kids, like, we're able to play this game and inspire, you know, kids, girls, boys all over this country to be able to do great things, because, you know, some of us were nowhere 4 or 5 years prior to this World Cup happening. You know, some of you guys didn't even know a lot of the players probably on our team 4 or 5 years ago. You know, some of them, like Kamal, Alistair, Tejan, you know, these guys popped up late. Even, myself, I didn't join until a little bit later. I feel like, you know, it should give a sense of belief to a lot of kids growing up that, like, yeah, it's anything's possible. So I think, obviously, despite the results, everything else, I think, was very good. We showed really well. We didn't change who we are. We played with the same freedom, bravery, and, you know, attacking mindset that, like, we always do, as if we were playing a CONCACAF team. So I think that's very important from a standpoint of, like, as a national team, as a association, to, you know, grow in that way and move forward, you know, and not be the team that has to, you know, we're playing against Belgium now, let's sit in a back five and have our attackers just sit in and counterattack. You know, it's like, no, let's play the way that we normally play. So I was really proud of the group in that sense, on the way we went forward with the games and how brave we were, and even, you know, playing against Morocco with, you know, just playing for self-respect at that point and still going out there and competing the way we did, you know, it's top, man. And again, I'm sure all the boys will say it, we're gutted that we weren't able to, you know, get any points out of that. But again, I think if you go and watch the games back, there's a lot of very positive things for people to take forward and move into 2026 with.
Dude, there's no question about it. Again, it was massive. I'm glad that the games are here next time, so that you guys will be able to probably get a bigger picture of, you know, just what it was like, the support back home, the numbers on television, despite the time of day it was, just the momentum that the program had, and yeah, how big it is in this country, and how, yeah, you guys as a group, just, you literally shocked the world. Like, that's the great thing about soccer, is it's not like, oh, let's shock the world, it's the NFL, it's like, yeah, just North America. It's like, no, like, these guys literally shocked the world. That you guys were press clippings globally after the Belgium game especially. I know you got to run. I do got to ask you one more, though. So all of this has happened, man. You guys have all this positive momentum as a group, but this is a two-parter. I wonder, you know, how connected the men's program is to the Canadian women's team that's playing in protest during the She Believes Cup. And I also wonder, like, how difficult it is when you have all this momentum as a group when there are so many issues with the governing body.
Yeah, first and foremost, obviously, I think we know what they're going through. We dealt with, obviously, something similar. And, yeah, it's tough, you know. When things are going well, you hope everything just falls into place, but sometimes it's not like that, and that's what they're dealing with right now. And I guess we're dealing with just as an entire whole, as an association right now. And, yeah, we're obviously we know what they're going through. We support them. We have they have our back in. And, you know, I think all of us in this want a common goal for each other. You know, we just want both men and women's side to just, you know, have put ourselves on the platforms that we think we deserve to be on. You know what I mean? They've had great show-ins as a women's national team for plenty of years now. And we've had a great show-in in recent years, but I think a very, very dominant performances and being able to, like I said, do what we did in such a short period of time once John took over is also very impressive. So I think just both sets know that, like, both of the women's and men's program are going to go nothing but forward and up from this point forward. So I think everyone just wants, you know, the respect they feel like they deserve and rightfully deserve. And, yeah, just put this national team, put this program in a better place. You know, we want, you know, I have a child, I have a son, and some other people may have daughters, and, you know, and maybe I'll have a daughter in the future as well, and I want them to be able to, you know, be proud Canadians, have their passports, if they choose to play soccer, be able to play for our national teams and feel like it's, you know, everything's being taken care of the way they feel like it should be, you know, and I think we're just setting the example again for kids and little ones to come after us, you know, with, you know, whatever it might be, with our play, obviously, first and foremost, but, you know, the way we're able to unite and stick together and get things done that we feel are very important for our country and both sets of national teams, you know, and this funnels all the way down into the youth national teams as well, which is good. So I think, yeah, obviously a tough moment for them. We had that tough moment as well. And, you know, it's still a work in progress for both sides. But, yeah, hopefully we get to a point where all of us all together with, like you said, governing body are on the exact same page and we can move forward, because I really think that is what everyone wants to do. You know, I think you have to put everything aside. They have a World Cup. There's another World Cup coming up for us in a couple of years. And there's tournaments like Nations League and Gold Cup and all this type of stuff. For them, She Believes Cup, that, you know, you want to be prepared for. You want to be focused on the football part and being able to produce what you need to produce on the pitch. So, yeah, we're with them, and I hope something gets resolved for just all parties so everyone can move forward in a positive mindset and, you know, just keep building. I don't think anyone's intention is to break people down or take shots at one person or another person. And even though it may feel like that at sometimes, I think the common goal is everyone just wants their national team, this national team in this country, to move forward the way it should.
100%, man. And that's it. I want people to be able to start, like, and especially, like, just our athletes to be able to focus on soccer and not all of the stuff that, yeah, they've been presented with as they're hitting the biggest moments in the program's history. Richie, you guys did the country incredibly proud. I know you feel that. I hope that you carry that excitement into this season with TFC. Best of luck to you, pal, and thanks for making the time today, buddy. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
Take care, man. See you, Richie. There's Richie Larea, member of the Canadian men's national team and TFC. Good guy. I like talking to him. That was really fun. I've been actually dying to catch up with a member of the Canadian soccer team for quite some time. That's the first interview I've done with someone since the World Cup. I actually am hoping to talk to even a couple of more of the guys because, yeah, I do. Well, one, I think it's really, really cool. I just think them going to that World Cup and reliving so many of those awesome memories is great. Who doesn't like hearing that stuff? I love his quote about this is now for Canada soccer. It's just the best. Like, that's their mentality as a group. They don't feel intimidated whatsoever by the bigger countries, by the teams that have been established for a really long time. But yeah, like, this isn't like to be a downer or anything like that, but part of me always goes, damn, that's as good as it's ever going to get. That run where the expectations were low, where, yeah, frankly, I hated saying it to him, but where we kept expecting, like, okay, they're going to lose this game, though. Okay, well, this is the one where we get the reality check. Okay, well, they're looking for a draw and then it ends up being a win? Holy crap. How real is this? How serious is this? Yeah, how that develops over the next 4 years when, yeah, they're already qualified. Like, they're in. These guys don't have to play those same games. I don't expect them to have any type of, how do I say this? Overconfidence? I can't imagine that now they think, oh, okay, we're there, we've done it, we've proven that we're as good as the USA and Mexico. Who knows how those clubs are going to look 4 years from now. And yeah, that Canada soccer stays hungry, but they're still not going to have quite those same tune-up games going into it. There isn't going to be that, okay, we have to stay undefeated mentality that they had leading in throughout the qualifiers. So yeah, watching this group have to kind of maintain that hunger, maintain that focus, maintain that momentum through a four-year cycle, super interesting to me and exciting. Fun times for Canada soccer, minus, again, every single thing that's off the pitch for these men and women who continue to deal with just that governing body that they are not happy with.